This is the Inch Podcast, a production of InsideCollegeHockey.com. Now, let's send it to our podcast host, Joe Gladyszewski.
Hello, this is the Inch Podcast, recorded April 16th, 2012. College hockey season's over, but that doesn't mean it's never a good excuse not to have a podcast or something, so we've got the staff together. We're going to talk about a lot of end-of-season stuff, kind of put a bow tie on the year that was. Bring in Inch editor Mike Eidelbus. Hi, Bus.
Well said. That was eloquent.
Yeah, I've been practicing that open since we got back from Tampa. All my hard work has paid off.
Yes.
Kevin Zeese, Hockey East senior writer. Hi, Kevin.
Greetings, Gladdy. How you doing tonight?
Doing well. WCHA senior writer Jess Myers. Hi, Jess.
I didn't get back from Tampa. I just decided to stay there. I'm still on the beach, I think.
Good. Good for you. And CCHA senior writer James Dowd. Hi, Dowd.
Good evening, Gladdy. Looking forward to another trip north to Pittsburgh next year.
Yeah, another big frozen. That'll be a good event. Maybe we'll get to that later, but we wanted to talk about some of the things that have gone on. We'll start with Boston College's championship, other Frozen Four thoughts, some commentary and explanation on an agenda we've somewhat pushed a little bit at the Frozen, which was that should Tampa be a permanent site for the men's Division I Frozen Four? And then we'll get into some individual award chatter, highlighted by Hobie Baker's stuff, All-America stuff, Coach of the Year stuff, etc. So let's start with Boston College. I'm a guy who likes it when the best team wins, and the best team won this year. So really complete Boston College team. The way they took apart Minnesota was something else. The score to me was a little bit misleading because Parker Milner made so many big saves on the Gophers when it was still a close game, and that could have been a lot closer. And I turned to some of you guys in the press box, I think, and said it's unfair for a team to have, you know, this much talent all over the ice and then have a goalie that erases all those mistakes. He to me was the real revelation of the tournament. Anybody else?
I mean, I definitely agree with that. Having been in Worcester and watching all four of the games that Boston College played, I mean, they're a great team from top to bottom. Like their three defensive pairings, I like their four forward lines. But I mean, Milner really stole the show all along in a way that I don't think we've seen, at least as long as I've been writing about college hockey.
Just going back to the Gophers a little bit with that semifinal game, we love yep. what they did. In the regionals against BU and North Dakota, right?
Yeah.
And what about that element of their inconsistency throughout the year? It kind of came back a little bit.
Yeah, a couple things out of that game. Number one, you know, Don Lucia said this after the game, but they emerged from the first 20 minutes having dominated Boston College. I mean, controlled the play, had a ton of shots on goal, and you know, they're down 1-0. And Lucia said BC essentially scored on their only scoring opportunity the first period. But that was just the way this BC team operated, that, you know, you think, oh, we're in good shape, we're dominating them, and bang, you're down a goal. And then the other thing that happened to the Gophers, and specifically in the second period, and, you know, not to single out any one or two guys, but, you know, they knew who they are and they admitted it after the game. But all year they'd talked about Minnesota being young on defense and that would be their weak link. And it really hadn't surfaced. And then, of course, you know, last game of the season, biggest stage, national TV, then it surfaces. You start turning over pucks uncharacteristically. And BC was just too good to do that against and survive it.
Buzz, what were your thoughts on the Eagles?
Well, I think that the two things that really stand out to me are not only the overall talent level,
you know, they're the best team in college hockey, and I think you can go a step further and say they're probably the most talented team. But within that, how those guys accept their roles, you know, not everybody can be on the first power play unit. Not everybody can be on the top line, or, you know, not everybody can be a top six forward. But yet they, you know, they buy into that team concept. They buy into what Jerry York's selling, and with good reason, obviously. You know, the results are show that his system and his method works, and you know they go out and compete. Whatever their role is, they just go out and do it. They don't complain. You know, you don't ever hear about any divisiveness or anything like that. I think the other thing that really stood out in both of those games was just the patience and the lack of panic. You look at that Minnesota game. Sure, they're leading 1-0, but the first period they're getting thoroughly outplayed, or at least outchanced. But yet, you know, they just, you know, stay the course. There was no running around. There was no urgency. It was just, you know, stick to our game, and we'll be all right. Sure enough, they were. And I think what you saw was, on the flip side, was Minnesota ending up panicking. At a point when they really didn't have a reason to. I mean, when you're out chancing them, when you're getting a lot of opportunities, sure, you might be frustrated, but despite what the scoreboard says, things are going your way, and you gotta, I think that you have to understand in your mind that eventually something's gonna turn your way. And the same thing in the championship game. You know, BC got the first goal, and it looked like it was gonna be a runaway. Or at least that's what everybody kind of thought it was going to be. But then Ferris comes back and scores, you know, not too long thereafter. And, you know, you think Ferris might get the momentum. And I think for a while there, Ferris did really outplay BC, especially in the second period. But again, BC just didn't panic, kept doing what they had done up till that point, and it worked out.
Kevin, you kept a close eye on BC all year, obviously, and most people know the story of how their season went after kind of an up and down first 20 games or so. What did you learn about this team, I guess, even looking forward to next year?
Well, first off, with regards to this season, the first thing that really caught my eye was just how they can adapt their game to play anybody. That they can play an up-tempo game, they can play a slow grinder game and be successful at it. And I think you see that a lot with, especially a lot of teams in college, where if you're used to skating up and down the ice and all of a sudden then you play a team that likes to play slow and methodical and possess the puck a little bit more, that those teams tend to struggle. And I think Boston College showed a tremendous amount of versatility and flexibility with adapting their game to play a number of different styles and be successful at it. As you had mentioned, though, too, with regards to Boston College and the Jerry York kind of system and, you know, getting guys to buy into roles, you know, you see that a lot with a lot of these players moving forward, that, you know, guys who may have been on what was officially called the third line, you know, next year they'll be first liners and, you know, they have to excel. I think you had the quote in your ode to Jerry York after the championship game about having guys be the best player in the country at their position. And I think that's the mentality that they have, is if you're going to be the fourth line center, be the best fourth line center in the country. Mm. And I think as long as that continues, that, you know, they may lose guys. They've lost already with three guys, three underclassmen, I think it is now, to the professional ranks already since the championship game. But it's not going to hurt that team in the long run. They may have a few growing pains early, but I think come the end of next season, they're going to be in the in contention again for postseason play.
I think you made an excellent point at the end when talking about BC. You know, saying they're going to have growing pains early.
Yeah.
Jerry York understands that, and he understands that, hey, you know, early in the season is the time when you work through all that stuff. You know, sure, it's nice to win all those games up front, but, you know, it's really in the back end. You want to get all the, you know, get everything sorted out, you know, figure out which pieces belong where, and then get that situated, and then start growing as a team. You know, and we've seen it on many occasions where BC has had, you know, an average or slightly above average start, maybe through the first 12, 15, whatever games, or through the Christmas break. And then all of a sudden, you know, at sometime in the second half of the season, the light just goes on and they start rolling over people. And I think, you know, that's obviously a credit to the coaching staff. But it's also, you know, I think that's a trickle-down effect too, and kind of goes hand in hand with what we see from them in games when they're just, you know, we see that patience, we see that resolve. I think that's, you know, I think that's a direct result of just how they approach everything.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. Don't want to forget about that first semifinal, even though nobody really wanted to remember it. or pay attention to it, I should say. But a good game, Union and Ferris. Both ways, chances both ways. You know, obviously that was kind of the undercard in everyone's perception of that game. But those are good teams. You know, you don't win two games in a row in the tournament on the same weekend without being a good team. And I liked what both of those teams did. I thought they handled themselves well. There wasn't any of the nervous, holy crap, I can't believe we're here stuff that we might have seen a little bit in Detroit with our IT.
Yeah, we saw it last year with Duluth and Notre Dame in that first game.
Yeah. So
neither of them could believe they were there.
We couldn't believe they were there after that first period.
Yeah.
So,
You alluded. I want to just mention one more thing about BC, Gladdy, because you mentioned the Detroit Frozen Four, and I wasn't there, but you know, a lot was made this year about the setting being in a non-traditional place, and you know, it really, once you got inside the rink, it's an NHL rink, and it's you know, got boards and everything. But Jerry York alluded to that a little bit about the fact that the last two Frozen Fours they'd been in have been kind of these novelty things, you know, this year being in Florida and, you know, being greeted by, you know, steel drums when you get off the plane and, you know, fans in shorts and all that. And then 2 years ago, of course, they have to go to Detroit and play in a football stadium and, you know, all of that kind of distraction. And the way they were able to just kind of put that behind them and just say, hey, we're here to play hockey and do it so effectively, that impressed me. You know, I thought just a great job by the coaching staff of keeping them task-oriented.
Yeah, in Jerry's post-game remarks, some people saw those or saw the press conferences, but he was very open and honest about having a formula, having a system, you know, figuring it out. What do? What don't you do? How do you travel? How do you practice? You know, what do you eat? When do you eat? You know, knowing that balance between having a plan and preparing for the task at hand, because it's a great experience and you want to take part in all the extraneous stuff that goes along with a championship weekend. But at the end of the day, you're also there to win two hockey games and get a trophy. And BC's really figured that part of it out. I couldn't help but notice the first day, and a lot of fans wouldn't have, you know, access to this, but that Wednesday, there's practices and press conferences, and teams are required to kind of stay around and be available for those. And Ferris State and Union were there all day. Like they never went home. I don't think they had a plan in mind. And Minnesota and Boston College were just right in and run right out. So they, you know, they had that that experience and that element of business that maybe the other teams didn't. But it didn't translate to the ice, I didn't think, for Ferris State or Union.
Well, I think, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I thought as the weekend went on, though, I think, you know, you guys mentioned the it not translating to the ice and the whole, oh, I can't believe we're here thing. I thought, you know, off the ice and, you know, listening to the coaches, listening to the players, and, you know, I had the pleasure of being able to cover Ferris State pretty closely that whole weekend, and, like, you saw those teams, like, grow and really do it. And by the end of the weekend, and even, you know, Rick Bennett and his team in the post game after they lost, and then again, you know, Friday afternoon and then Saturday before the game and then during and after the game, I thought, like, Ferris and Union really kind of came into their own and really looked like they belong there. Like you said, there are teams in the past that have continued with that. We're the underdog. We're the under, you know. And I thought both those teams looked mature beyond their postseason experience, if that makes sense.
I think the one thing that maybe a differentiation you have to make between the you know, somebody like BC who's been there a bunch of times and a team like Ferris State obviously making it the first trip to the Frozen Four. I mean, Bob Daniels might have been the most wide-eyed of anybody in that Ferris State contingent. I mean, you know, he even when he's, you know, the first press conference on Wednesday, he was talking about how great everything was. And, you know, I think that by doing that, and I don't know if it was, you know, sort of a subliminal type thing or what, but he gave his kids the okay to, hey, go ahead and enjoy yourself. This should be one of the greatest experiences of your life. And the way he talked about it, I don't want to say in awe, but I mean, I think there was a certain extent of a kid in a candy store feeling for him when he was down there. And I think, I think when a first time team like that goes into that situation, they tend to kind of, well, you know, some of them maybe think, how should we act in this situation? As opposed to, you know, in this case, I think Ferris took the lead from Bob Daniels and, you know, he obviously said, hey, we're going to enjoy this. And they enjoyed it. I'm sure they didn't enjoy losing to BC, but you know, they gave Boston College a heck of a game, and they played a pretty good game in that title game.
Definitely don't ask them what they think about BC.
Yeah, they didn't string about BC, which agree with.
Yeah, I mean,
You know, props to Taylor Nelson for the way he handled that, and most people listening probably won't know what we're talking about, but they were just after the game and throughout, you know, after they beat Union, I guess, and then after BC won, they're just peppered with questions for, 48 hours or so there. How good is BC? Like, how impressed are you by BC? Isn't BC really great? BC's got this great depth. What are you going to do about it? And, you know, finally after the game, you know, they were, I guess somebody asked one question too many of the Ferris State goalie, Taylor Nelson, and he responded, and I would say it was hostile, but, you know, he responded in a way that showed his frustration with that, and I respect him for it, you know?
Yeah, he was pretty terse, and the question was pretty ridiculous, to be honest with you. I mean,
yeah.
It was basically, you know, sure, the gist of it, and it was, yeah, I know you just lost, but really, how great is BC? I mean, it was kind of the tone of the question. And I mean, Nelson, you have to give him credit for speaking what's on his mind at the same time showing some pretty, some good restraint. I mean, he basically said, I don't know. It's like, what do you want me to say?
I
think kind of question is that. What do you want me to say? I probably would have walked down there and punched the guy in the head. But, I think, you know, give Ferris State credit. I mean, they played two darn good games, and, you know, they had some rough breaks. You know, Brett Weiss-Opel did not have a very good game on defense on Saturday.
Which is unfortunate because yeah. he was really one of the reasons they were there. If you watched,
and he had
previous
a nice game
three games they played.
Yeah, absolutely. He just had a tough night on Saturday, and you know, and Goodrow scores that goal, and doesn't matter, you know. It doesn't matter who he – Drew Doughty could be back there, and he doesn't – you know, he doesn't keep that from happening. So, but, yeah, it was – you know, I think you obviously have to be impressed with Boston College, but at the same time, you have to be impressed with Ferris too.
I would give Ferris credit in that game. It didn't go their way, and if you look at the box score, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now, it's going to look – not as close as that game was. I think Ferris did exactly what they wanted to do there, and there was a little bit of, you know, lack of puck luck for them, and there was Parker Milner.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the same thing. Obviously, Milner was great, but the same thing about the puck luck. How many times did we see, you know, guys have scoring chances and maybe the puck hops over their stick or the pass isn't, you know, it's a little behind him or something like that. You know, it just – that's just the way things seem to go that night for Ferris.
Yeah, but, I give them credit, though. That's what they needed to do, and I think there were four games in the NCAA tournament, and the two teams that were the least hyped in Air Force and Ferris State were the ones that were best able to achieve what they needed to achieve against Boston College and to dictate – to bring the game to where they needed to be to have a chance, and neither one of them got the break, but – you know, for all the talk about, you know, deep teams and high flying teams and NHL draft picks and all that, I thought both Air Force and Ferris deserve credit in my book for their play and being able to bring the game to the level they needed to have a chance to win, and a bounce or two or a slight mental lapse by Parker Milner in that game is very, very different in the closing minutes.
You had mentioned about the wide-eyed almost approach that Bob Daniels had taken, and I guess I kind of viewed it a little bit differently. Not that it was necessarily sort of this whole trying to take it everything in. I think I kind of viewed it as more of a reverent type of attitude, almost more like a Ray Bourque finally getting his chance at the Stanley Cup kind of thing. It's the guy who's coached for 20 years. You know, he understands just how rare and how special this occasion was, and I think he was just trying to make sure that he saw everything. And that, to me, was one of the best things that I enjoyed about that the entire weekend was just his entire approach to everything. That, you know, I don't want to miss any of this because I know just how difficult it is to get here. And, you know, I talked to Bob up at Green Bay after they had beaten Cornell to get to the Frozen Four, and he kind of had that same sort of attitude with him at that point. Like, you know, this is something that I've been doing this for 20 years, and you know, this is the first time that we're going to go, and you never know, you may not get a chance to go back there ever again. And you know, I think he and his team carried themselves exceptionally well, and I thought they definitely have made their school has a lot to be proud of that bunch.
Gladdy, I know that we must bring up 04 Denver on every podcast.
That team.
But yeah, I saw a lot of similarities between them and Ferris. You know, thinking back to 04 when those guys were talking about when those Denver guys were talking about going to the practice and getting a police escort and running red lights.
Yep.
I mean, George Gwozdecki thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And I think that I think you're right on, Kevin, is, you know, not only did they appreciate it and know that, you know, this isn't something that happens every year, but also, you know, enjoy it while you can. And I think we saw that. And I mean, I think Daniels' enthusiasm for being there and just, I think it really brought a renewed energy to everything around that tournament. I mean, they were excited to be there. Their fans obviously were super excited to be there and showed up. They had a great showing, and, you know, obviously, you know, like we said before, they're disappointed, but, you know, I think that school as a whole, collectively, you know, the players, the team, the coaches, the fans, you know, they didn't leave any stone unturned while they were in Tampa. I mean, they took it in. They enjoyed the experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. And personally speaking, I enjoyed having a little different flavor there. You know, it was nice to see those schools get rewarded and have that opportunity. Because in those communities, that hockey's a big deal. They may not be a big deal on a national stage. They might not be on TV every weekend, but they're a big deal in those little small towns. And good for all the people who have been a part of those programs for a long time. I know it meant a lot to them. So a little stick tap to those folks. Bus, let's move a little bit away from the games and the teams and talk about Tampa as a venue. You wrote a piece that kind of came to light every day we were there more and more, and talking amongst ourselves about how that city might work out if the Frozen Four were there every year.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was kind of thinking about it the other day, about the experience in Tampa, and just, you know, in a way, and obviously this is nothing I have ever experienced, but in a way it was kind of like I felt like I was on a recruiting trip going to university where, you know, you go just kind of because it's on your schedule, and then you get there and you're absolutely blown away. And, you know, when I got down there, and actually when it was announced, I was dead set against Tampa. I thought, you know what, this is going to be awful.
As much as the day before you went down there, you were dead set against it.
Pretty much. The only thing that Tampa had working in its favor was that it wasn't Orlando, which is where I was the day before the tournament and couldn't wait to get out of because it was so freaking hot. And there were so many people in the Disney parks. But nevertheless, you know, slowly as the weekend went along, and, you know, we as a staff had an occasion to kind of see, I would say, a pretty decent chunk of the city. There were a few things that really stuck out to me. One was, it seemed like just about every place we went, and we didn't necessarily stick around the arena a lot. I mean, we were all over town. It seemed that everybody kind of, you know, knew that there was a hockey tournament in town, asked if we were there for the hockey tournament. I don't know what gave us away, but, you know, I would say more often than not that happened, where we were asked about the hockey tournament and so on and so forth. There's a lot to do there. You can tell that it's a city that's had a lot of experience hosting big events. You know, and that's something we touched on in the piece that I wrote the night of the Frozen of the championship game. And I think the most important thing that kind of struck me was, you know, from October till March or whenever, you know, college hockey fans are traipsing in and out of arenas, you know, mostly in the northern tier of states, you know, trudging through the snow, fighting cold winds, you know, gloomy weather, in and out of rinks. And to have the last weekend of the season in a place, a sunny, warm, inviting climate like Tampa, and a city that really embraced the event, I thought, in a ton of different ways, it just felt like a perfect cap to the season. And I think, Gladdy, you were the one that brought up the notion of this, you know, this is college hockey's bowl game. And it really felt like that. It really felt like it was...
it's a reward.
Yeah, it really felt like it was, and it wasn't just a reward for the teams that were there. I think it was a reward for everybody that was there. It was a reward for the fans, whose teams were in it and weren't in it. I mean, obviously it was a reward for us. You know, we had a great time, in town. And, I think I like the idea of having a college hockey bowl game. You know where it's going to be every year. First weekend in April, you're going to Tampa. You know, some people are going to complain or bring up the thing that, you know, it wasn't a sellout, but I don't put that on the host city as much as I put that on hockey fans who know years in advance when the event is. You know, it's your job to get to the games. It's not Tampa's job to, you know, to get you down there. But I think if you keep
and
having,
I think if it's an every year thing, it draws the local market a little stronger.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And there were certainly people that started to make that connection as the week went by. I think between, you know, Marty St. Louis played in college and Teddy Purcell and, you know, go down the list. So.
Well, I think also, like, knowing a few people who live down there that aren't hockey fans and do, you know, personally and then professionally with my job outside of Inch, talking to some people who live in the city, I think there wasn't a ton of awareness about the event once it was there, like before it was there. But once they went by the rink, they saw all this energy, they saw the signage, which is something, I mean, you couldn't even get out of the airport without seeing signs announcing mm-hmm. the Frozen Four. By the time you got to the baggage claim, you'd seen it three or four. But people were intrigued by the event. And so if it was there every year, I think that last 1,000 or 2,000 seats would be filled by local people, you know? I really do. I think that there are people that were intrigued by it, and if they had known about it before and knew the energy around the Frozen before, they would have been there.
And you can do group sales.
Yeah. There's two other points, I think, that can be made. And one is really minor, but I didn't see a lot of the local media coverage, but what I did see, they did a really good job of getting college hockey out, you know, especially in the newspapers. And I know there were TV people there, too, but especially in the newspapers, I thought they did a pretty, actually, they did a very admirable job of covering the tournament. And the second is, you know, people complain about, or you can envision that one of the complaints would be, oh, you can't have it in the same place every year. You know, you got to move it around. Find a college baseball fan and ask them if they hate going to Omaha every year for the College World Series.
Yeah.
To a person, you will find that. Everybody, I've talked to quite a few people who've been to it, and everybody absolutely loves it. Everybody absolutely loves it. So there is a precedent there to keep it in the same spot.
Well, people really hate the Rose Bowl, too, you know.
Well, there's that, but that's college football isn't the NCAA. We know that. That's run by somebody else.
I live in Minnesota. What's the Rose Bowl? Sorry. Talking to a Michigan grad.
I was going to say, I was going to defer to Gladdy to tell you, but I don't know that he would know either.
Ooh.
Ow.
It's Ouch. It's
Oh, that's that parade, right?
It's the aspiration. It's the hopes and dreams.
I told friends of mine, you know, and I agree with everything you guys have said. I mean, fantastic event, and, you know, I took a little different approach to it. I went down a week early with family and made kind of a family/work trip out of it and spent a lot of time at the beach and you know, spent equal amounts of time covering hockey. Both venues were fantastic, but I told friends of mine in the Twin Cities media, now I finally figured out what guys who get to cover spring training every year get. And you're absolutely right. It is kind of this reward at the end of a long winter and, you know, to go and put on a pair of shorts and go someplace comfortable. I mean, it was just really nice on a lot of levels.
I think that's how the locals were able to recognize that you were there for hockey.
That's right.
Outside of doubt, every one of us was probably white as can be, so.
Right.
They can tell who the Northerners are.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you bring that up in jest, but I can look at it separately and outside of the fact that it's nice weather and a reward at the end of a long winter, because I obviously haven't experienced that this year. Although
sure.
most of you didn't either. But
yeah, we didn't have much of a winter.
Independently, Tampa really killed it. Like, that was a great event, independent of the fact that it was nice weather outside. I don't want to discount the job that the rink did, that the Lightning and whoever was involved from their perspective did, that the townspeople, the people of Tampa did, because that event was awesome regardless of the fact that the weather was nice.
Yeah, looking back a few years, there was really nice weather in Columbus, and I don't remember us saying this about Columbus. So.
Yeah.
Can I just say, as this being my first Frozen that I've ever attended,
yes.
I'm actually very afraid that, the standard has been set so high. I'm concerned. Pittsburgh, I think, will be good next year. And having been to Philadelphia a couple times myself, I'm a little bit concerned that Tampa has set a standard that there is no possible way that Philadelphia can match.
That's a reasonable thought. Some are better than others, there's no doubt about it. But even the worst of the Frozens, and I've been to 12 now, are still a pretty good time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so.
But it's just, all right, it's, in my view, it's sort of like, okay, guys, the bar's been set.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's been, you can look back over the,
And they're better for different reasons. Some years the games are unbelievable. Some years the rink's unbelievable. Some years the weather, the setup, or the social activities. There's all so many different aspects of it, and usually there's some kind of highlight. And
proximity.
This one just kind of hit.
I was going to mention proximity. Ironically, friends of mine who cover college basketball have said that when they had the Final Four in Tampa, it was the worst place they've ever had it, because everyone stayed in downtown Tampa. The games were in St. Petersburg, which is like 20 miles away, and you wound up spending all your time, in a bus or in a cab. And some of the not bad, but some of the lesser successful Frozen Fours we've been to, it's been the same problem. Not to pick on Columbus, but that was an issue there, where everybody was staying in downtown Columbus. The games were, 15, 20 minutes away. And that's just another way that I think Tampa just really killed it. I mean, the proximity of, open-air bars and restaurants, the rink, the hotels, all being within, literally like a five-minute walk of each other. And another thing I want to tip my hat to Tampa for, they had this channel side area with numerous bars. What they did was each bar was like, one bar rebranded itself as the Gopher Hole. One rebranded itself as the Eagle's Nest. Like, if you were from one of the four teams and you were from out of town and you didn't know where to go, here's our bar. This is where all our fans are going to be. I mean, just kind of a neat idea that I hadn't seen before.
I think they did that in Detroit with
around Ford Field.
Yeah, because obviously the Chelios's place was the Wisconsin hangout, and I knew they. But again,
great idea.
That was different because of Tigers as well.
Yeah, that was it.
So.
Well, and I think that, we comment on, how well run and how smooth it was, and not just for the inside the arena stuff, but everything, all the ancillary stuff that goes on outside. I mean, the Tampa Sports Commission or Tampa Bay Sports Commission, I don't know exactly what their name is, but, obviously they had a big role in putting this thing together. And, we're talking about a group that does Super Bowls. So the Frozen Four is going to be, they're going to have a, They're going to be able to lock this thing down pretty good when it comes to hosting it, and they did. I mean, every detail, inside and out, was 100%, right on. I mean, I try to think of a complaint, I can't. And I, you know, I had my mind made up going in that it was going to be terrible. And I was flat out wrong.
And to folks out there who don't know Mike Eidelbiss personally, he's not a Pollyanna. Let's just say that.
No.
You tend to take a critical eye of some things, and so that kind of praise is noteworthy.
I think I'm objective. I don't sugarcoat. But, hey, it was great. And I don't think the NCAA would do something like that, make a permanent site. I guess, you know, we can debate whether it'll happen or not, and I don't think it will. But it would be nice to try for a couple years, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've talked about it before. I don't have a screaming need to go to Boston for any reason.
Right. They have college hockey all the time. October 1 till March 30th, you get college hockey.
But I'm not even going to knock other cities and say I don't have a need to go here or don't have a need to go there. It's just like I just want to go to a great Frozen, have a good time, see good hockey, be around people that care about it, and feel like the event is welcome and part of town, and Tampa can clearly do that.
Yeah. The only stakeholder to me who would have a gripe would be the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Yeah.
Right.
Because generally it would mean they'd miss their last the last three games of the regular season or last two games of the regular season, they'd have to play on them. So that to me is the biggest stakeholder in preventing this, and the NCAA, of course. But they'd be the only people with a legitimate gripe, I think. So.
Yeah, I agree with that.
No, I mean, you're right. You're right, James. I mean, you don't have to rip other cities to make a case for why it should be there. I mean, the College World Series, you could put the College World Series at Wrigley Field and it would be a fantastic event. But why do it when you've got something that works so well?
Yeah.
I don't think it would be a fantastic event.
I think it would be a drunk-tastic event at Wrigley Field.
Well, I don't think, you know, the city wouldn't embrace it. It would be lost.
Yeah.
So many other things to do there that, you know, it's not going to find it. It's not going to be this big event. Although the fans might thank you for kicking the Cubs out of the town for 2 weeks.
Yeah. A bunch of SEC people rolling in on Chicago, Dad?
Trouble.
All right, let's move on to some award type things here. We've gotten some Twitter gripes, we've gotten some comments and suggestions and things, and we'll address some of these with what we've thought about. I guess we'll start with I want to start with a generalization, and it's a point I made, and this covers all things, all parts of this from here forward, is these are preferences. You know, and you can disagree with people all you want. It's healthy and it's fine. But the manner in which you do it is a little off-putting sometimes. You know, make a case other than you're stupid or you hate my team. Because that doesn't make any sense. That's one of the things that kind of, you know, had taken me by surprise. Not by surprise. I've seen it before. The other thing is, very impressed and love the fact that people care so much about their teams. You know, it's kind of confusing to me though at times when you see someone whose Twitter handle or profile picture is them wearing a sweater of Team ABC, and you know their Twitter handle is Team ABC fan number one, go team, and then they say you're biased. that kind of like, wait a minute here. You're the one that has a stake in this argument, and we generally don't. What we base our decisions on are sitting back, watching as many games as we can all year long, speaking with each other who see a lot of the teams and a lot of the games, whereas, you know, Kevin might be more familiar with Northeastern or Maine or New Hampshire than I would be, and Dowd would know more about Western Michigan and Fair State, whereas I would know more about Union and Harford. So that's kind of where this all comes from. So just before all the rest of this stuff, there's data and there's reason. And we publish our reasoning and we publish our thoughts. The other thing, I guess I keep saying the other thing, the next thing, to make a choice of one guy isn't a slight against the other guys. You know, just because we make a call of player X or team Y is number one, or this is our choice for blank award of the year. If we say your guy is the second best guy in this category, that's an unbelievable thing. Or third, you know, or fourth, or whatever. Out of all the peers he has in college hockey, to be in that conversation, be considered, it's not a slight, it's not a diss, it's not a bias. It's just a preference. So all that stuff is there, and I just wanted to, before we get into the one by ones,
you know,
go ahead.
I just want to say one other thing about that. Like, pay attention to what we say and what we write. You know, you listen to the podcast, you read what we write year in and year out, and you know, it evens itself out. I mean, we do watch a lot of games. You know, I'm thinking about one of these calls in particular that we've gotten a lot of grief about. You know, a couple years ago, there was a player on that same team that I repeatedly was talking about as the best player in the country, and that I thought they were the best team, and I thought they had a chance to win the national title, and they didn't. And, you know, at that point, that's what we thought, and that's what we observed. And so I just want to reassure people, you know, if you pay attention over time, I think you'll see that there's no pattern of We have it out for this team. We have it out for that team. We have it out for this league or that league. You know, I try and watch as much as I can, and I know Gladdy and Bus for sure watch even more than I do. So,
yeah. Anyway, it is what it is. That being said, let's start with Bus. Are you back?
Yep.
Gladdy, let me just say one thing, too. To piggyback on a point you've made several times about the conference, you know, I'm in favor of this conference, I'm not in favor of that conference. I love the fact that in some of the criticism we got, we were clearly anti-WCHA with who we picked for one award, and clearly blindly pro-WCHA with who we picked for another award. So, good work.
Yeah.
We're firmly on both sides of the issue.
We're biased against 58 teams, or we're right. Biased in favor. We say we're biased in favor of 58 teams. Right. Teams, not conference, not league, teams. They're all a bunch of teams. So, you want to start with coach stuff, Bus?
Sure, as long as my voice holds out, I'll try to power through it. You know, we got a little bit of blowback on picking Dave Haxtell of North Dakota as our coach of the year. We had Norm Bazin of Lowell as our runner-up, and I think you can fairly assume that that Bob Daniels is probably number three on our list.
No.
You know, you could have put any of those three guys in there. And I don't. I think you've got a deserving winner. And I know people got on. We had, you know, more than a few people get on our case about picking Haxtell over the other two guys. And this is actually something we've talked about before, maybe not on a podcast, but
I brought it up on the podcast. If you're going where I think you're going,
yeah, I think you're probably.
I'll interject here. Who says your team has to? What's the precursor that says your team has to be bad?
Yeah,
the year before to make you a great coach. You know, look at the circumstances and how much of it is circumstance, how much of it is, you know, you get a great bounce, how much of it is the other teams that you're playing against aren't really having that great of a year, the traditional powers, so to speak. There's a window of opportunity, and you have the right mix of a senior class and a hot goalie, and all those things come together. You know, how much of that is coaching? And it's hard to put a value on that. And if a team like Ferris State or UMass Lowell, who made such huge strides and outperformed expectations, or maybe a Harvard team this year or Colgate even, that went way up what they had done over the previous year, you know, so these guys next year, if they are 16 and 20 and 5, you know, did they become that much worse of a coach from one year to the next? I mean, that to me is the unknown. And people never look at it that way, because there's always that next story.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, we can see what Bob Daniels did. And I know that was obviously something that James was on from the start. You know, he recognized that the makeup of his team this year was different than the makeup in past. You know, he felt like he had a little bit more offense to work with, and he tailored his team to use that to his advantage. You know, with at Lowell, you know, new guy coming in, he gave everybody a clean slate. He said, you know what, we're not going to start with, you know, with any pluses or minuses. Everybody gets a chance, and you know, that was a program that needed to hit the reset button. Dave Haxtell really didn't get a chance to, you know, come into the season and say, okay, here's what we've got. Here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, he has, you know, loses a kid to Major Junior, loses one to NCAA clearinghouse issues, then starts losing guys to injury. You know, he didn't have a chance to, you know, sit through a summer and figure out how he's going to retool. He's literally out there with duct tape and, you know, a stapler trying to put things together. And with all the stuff that's happening to North Dakota throughout the course of the season, I mean, the expectations there do not drop. It's WCHA titles. It's getting the Frozen Four. It's national championships. Those remain constant, you know, whether they're 0-30 or 30-0. And, you know, some people, you know, one of the comments that I saw on Twitter or email was, oh, you know, good choice for picking Dave Haxtell. They were picked to finish whatever in the WCHA, and they finished fourth. Well, it's amazing they finished fourth. It's amazing that they somehow won the WCHA playoff title. It's amazing they somehow got a number one seed in the NCAA tournament when they're basically, you know, had every healthy guy playing for about 2 months. I mean, think about that.
It was about a half dozen nights that they couldn't dress the full lineup.
Right.
Yeah.
And on those nights, and some of those nights, you know, they had a couple walk-ons there on the, you know, on the filling out spots, and Joe Gleason, who was really a defenseman, playing forward. It was to the point where that coaching staff was just kind of throwing ideas against the wall and seeing if they stuck.
I mentioned this on an earlier podcast, though, too. And what impressed me most, seeing North Dakota up close and knowing what that program has been historically and seeing what they were this year, is this was a coaching staff. And this is, you know, praise Dave Haxtell all you want, but it's also Brad Berry. It's also Kerry Eads. You know, and they really are a team in the purest sense of the word, you know, coaching this team. The way they realized, okay, this is the hand we've been dealt. We can't play the type of game we normally play. We have to reinvent ourselves, and the way they were able to do that, that's what impressed me the most. It wasn't, you know, we were picked to finish here and we finished here, or, you know, the team was this kind of mess and we turned them into this much gel. It was, you know, we took this lousy hand we were dealt and we managed to make something of it with all of the, as you mentioned, you know, the crap they've dealt with, the constant distraction over the nickname, which, you know, I know they deny that it means anything to them, but it does. I mean, when that's in the paper every day, and when, you know, you're coming to every visiting building and there's a protest outside or there's people asking you about it, you know, that's going to draw you away from the task at hand over time. And to put all of that aside and put the year together was what impressed me the most.
Yeah, there you go. That's that's kind of the reasoning here. We also know. I guess I should have said in my my opening statement here. We know we're not going to change anybody's minds. You guys are stubborn, but we're right. So,
do you want to repeat the Inch mantra? Yeah. We have a website.
Go ahead, start your own website. Name whoever you want for Player of the Year. We don't mind.
You know, the other thing
I just
think of one thing I want to say on Bob Daniels, because obviously that's you know, a team that I followed pretty closely, and I stand behind the pick of the site, and I want to say that by no means do I think that it's a slight to what Bob Daniels did, but if you're that worked up about you know, Bob Daniels not getting it this year, and you think that he did something so much different, something completely different this year than he's done in years past, then you can't be that big of a Ferris fan, because you haven't been paying attention the last few years then. You know, Bus alluded to before, you know, we've been talking about Ferris for a long time. I don't think none of us picked them to win the CCHA. None of us picked them to get to the national championship game. But we knew that this was a team that could outperform what the typical Ferris State team did, because Bob Daniels told us that, you know, back in August or September or October, and they delivered on it. But this is really, I don't know, I guess it's, I don't want to say insulting, but, you know, it's, I guess it discredits what a solid program that's there, you know, if that makes any sense at all. You know, it's a special year for Ferris, yes. It's a year that they're going to remember for a really long time, and it might be a height that they don't reach again for a very long time. But it really isn't – this team wasn't that much better than Bob Daniels' teams typically have been the last few years. If, you know, there was some experience and there were a bunch of things that clicked right for them, as Gladdy mentioned. But, you know, this was not, you know, one magical season. So I guess I
definitely get what you're saying there. You know, really the big difference between this team of Ferris and the teams in years past is you had a Jordy Johnston, a guy who could score some goals. You had Chad Billens, you know, the kind of, you know, really mobile offensive type defenseman. And you had a good, you know, they've always had good goaltending and they've always had good defense.
Two All-American goalies in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, that's saying something. You know, and this year they had, you know, more scoring depth than they've had probably in, you know, maybe going back to the Chris Kunitz days or Bragg, you know, a little after that when they had Nesbitt and those guys. But, you know, this year obviously was impressive, you know, and you know, hats off to Bob Daniels for recognizing that he had a team that his makeup was a little different and he could do some different things with them. But I think just as impressive are the years when he doesn't have the goal scoring, you know, when his team has to be disciplined and stick to its system, and he still got them hovering around, you know, a home ice spot for the CCHA playoffs or a bye. I mean, that's, to me, it's just as impressive.
Yeah. No, I that's what I was getting at.
If I can just also chime in one really, really quick thought on this. For, you know, it, obviously being the Hockey East guy paying attention there, it's one thing for me to look at a coach like Jerry York for all of his accomplishments, all of his team titles. The guy's won one National Coach of the Year award.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You know, so to be even in the conversation here, you know, these guys like Bob Daniels, Norm Bazin, you know, it's a tremendous accomplishment. It says that you have done a tremendous, tremendous job with your team. It's not a slight, as you had mentioned in the open there, Gladdy. You know, it's a great thing just to be in the conversation.
Yeah, and, you know, and to me, the whole concept of Coach of the Year is you know, I'd rather have coach of the 3 years or 4 years. You know, it seems with every new hire, there's always an uptick. Mm-hmm. You know, how many cases have you seen, especially recently? Oh, new guy, you know, they're going to have a little, you know, kick in the pants. And then, you know, they're still realizing why, maybe they, that job came open. you know, there's some obstacles there. I mean, You look at a coach like Brown, Brendan Whitted. You know, he walked in. Roger Grillo had left. Brown really kind of took off that 1 year. They had some real good parts in that senior class that he inherited and got the most out of them. You know, there was a boost of energy and a little bit of recommitment and maybe some fresh air around that program. But now they're kind of back, and talking with him even this year, it was like, you know, it's taken a little longer. It takes longer. Everybody wants to do it right away, but that's not how it works. And you see those little upticks, and that to me is something that you got to keep an eye on. And you know, like you guys said about Ferris State, was it Bob Daniels realizing what he had and making it all work? You know, sure, that's a big part of it, but did Jordy Johnson have more to do with their success, or did Chad Billings have more to do with their success, or did Doug Carr, you know, mm-hmm. at Lowell have as much to do with their success, or you know, a guy like Scott Wilson? So those things are all there to, and that's why it's kind of the toughest one. Let's talk defensemen next. A great year for defensemen. I mean, I can't recall a year and. I could go look, I'm sure, but four defensemen are Hobey Baker finalists out of the 10, which is, to me, very telling and unbelievable about what kind of year it was for the Blue Liners, including the fact that none of those guys were Danny Biega, who was tremendous. So it was a big year for defense and a lot of big names from big programs. Our choice was Torrey Krug. First-team All-American, CCHA Player of the Year, certainly a lot of accolades there. Michigan State, again, you know, another uptick with a new coach in Tom Anastas. And they made the NCAA tournament, you know, with not much else going on around Krug. And we talked about him throughout the year. That's a pick we made and kind of stuck by it. Obviously, Wisconsin folks were upset about that. And there's no denying that Justin Schultz is a tremendous player. But as I said, we had to look at two guys or three guys or four guys, and we made a choice. And that's where we stand. And, you know, and our reasoning was in that article, the things we pointed at. And it's not meant to dress down the Wisconsin candidate or Justin Schultz. I watched two Badgers games that I can recall and was overwhelmed at his ability, and I think he'll be a great pro. But in the overall scheme of things, what Torrey Krug did for his team, to me, had a better year.
Yeah, I would agree, and I'm a guy who was in the Schultz camp until about a week ago when we started this discussion, and you know, I started looking at things and looking at numbers. And there were really two things that stuck out in my mind. You know, and I was ready to write in Schultz. You know, he had an outstanding year. There's no question about it. But I think there's also a tendency to kind of look at a player's body of work over, you know, he's been on the radar for 3 years, you know, going back to when he's a freshman. But the two things that really jumped out for me was, one, you know, you looked at the game by looked at the game-by-game numbers when Wisconsin really started to play well toward the end of the season, you know, over the last month or 6 weeks, and his point production was not what it was during the, you know, the first two-thirds of the season. I don't know, you know, maybe it's a little too much of a generalization to make a correlation between the two, but still it's something that stuck in my mind. The other thing that I came to realize about Krug is that, you know, we talked about Michigan State throughout the season and how, you know, they did not have a ton of talent. You know, they have some nice players, but, you know, nobody that's really outside of Krug, nobody that's going to make your head turn. And, thinking about him on that team, having to be a defenseman and knowing that your team's offense revolves around you and the things that you provide, and that if your team is going to win, you need to be the person that generates the offense from the blue line, and then going out and being able to do it is, I mean, it's really amazing. You know, kind of tweeting back and forth with some Wisconsin people tonight, Monday night, and, you know, without Krug, Michigan State is probably, you know, they're probably Mankato with less goal scoring talent.
Yeah.
And probably better goaltending, but and I don't think I'm that far off in making that parallel. So, I mean, I saw Krug play a few times, just the load that he had to carry being the guy that had to create offense for that team, and then being able to do it and being able to lead them to the NCAA tournament really is quite remarkable. And again, it's not a knock on Schultz. It's just
it's a preference,
right?
We thought about it.
Yeah,
those are our reasons. There you go.
Boom.
Player of the year. Is this where it gets good?
I guess.
I don't know. I had some back and forth on Friday with some Duluth fans, and somewhat jokingly started the conversation with, I'd be willing to discuss this with you as soon as you tell me how many Colgate games you saw, knowing, you know, the joking part of it being that Colgate, you know, they're hard to see.
Right.
They're not on TV that much. I saw them, fortunately, you know, being here in ECAC hockey where I live and cover this league, I'm able to get to their rink somewhat, you know, with relative ease if I'd like. And there's a regional sports network here that just covers basically upstate New York and shows a lot of college events, American Hockey League, stuff like that, and Time Warner Cable Sports. And they're very Colgate friendly across all sports, football, lacrosse, etc. So, you know, you get to see him on TV, and this is not something that we've brought up, you know. And to me, it was a pretty easy call. Again, not to take anything away from Jack Conley or Spencer Abbott, liked him a lot. One of the distinguishing characteristics was who's the guy. Who's the guy on this team? And you watch that Colgate team, and it's Austin Smith. And Chris Wagner's terrific. He plays with an unbelievable centerman. Obviously, Anaheim thought so. Signed him after his sophomore season, that being Chris Wagner. But every time I saw Duluth, it was other guys to me, you know. And that is you know, not very statistical and not very analytical, but – but the looks test, to me, that kind of held true, and that's just one part of it. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I think that's pretty sound. I mean, I think if you look at Abbott, you look at Connolly, you look at Smith, the numbers are there for all of them, and you can look at power play goals, you can look at game winning goals, you know, you can bend the numbers any way you want, but I think you're absolutely right there that it's really impressive to take a team and make something out of I don't want to say nothing, but I guess to the same extent that we're talking about Krug, you know, where would the team be without Austin Smith?
Yeah, I'll tell you where. 12th place in ECAC hockey, where they were the year before. Yeah. And he had battled injuries his first 3 years.
Yeah. And I saw Connolly and Spencer Abbott play in person, and they both really impressed me in losses, as a matter of fact. You know, I like the way they play. I like they're just good all-around players. But I think, you know, it's really sound to me when, you know, the point that you're making, I guess, you know, that he's the guy, and you know, you're looking for player of the year. To me, it's not just he's a good player, he's that. I guess I don't have anything to add. I just want to voice my support behind what you're saying. I don't want, you know, it to be taken, you know, you're the ECAC guy, and I don't want people to sit there and say that's just the ECAC guy talking. I mean, to me, I haven't seen a lot of Austin Smith play, but I know what the numbers are, and I know what he's surrounded with. I've seen Connolly play. I've seen Abbott play. I like them both. But, you know, for Smith to do what he did with the people around him, much like Torrey Krug, much like Dave Haxtell, I mean, I think there's kind of a common theme here.
36 goals. 36.
Yeah, I think it kind of starts there.
That's where we started when we started writing the Hobie Tracker. Trackler? You know, back back in, you know, maybe I think we checked in around Thanksgiving with the first one, and then basically every couple weeks from January 1st on. For us, it's the goals, and it always has been. You know, if you've read Inch over the last 10 years, that's kind of where we've stood. That's our again, here's the word again, that's our preference. So,
well, and kind of cutting you off and heading off maybe an argument that somebody's going to make is, we say, you know, goals are our preference. Somebody's going to come in and say, well, what about Matt Fratton last year? And I think it kind of ties in with Smith a little bit. When you look at the numbers that Fratton put up, or that Andy Mealy, who we went with for our player of the year last year, I mean, he put up 70-some points, which was, I want to say the exact number was 71 or 72, which was the most in like a decade.
Yeah.
So, you know, in going with Mealy and his total points over Fratton and his goals, and I know we obviously had that big breakdown between all those guys that we don't need to get into, you know, I think we framed it in a little bit of a historical perspective. And I kind of think that we did that with Smith, too. You know, when you look at 36 goals, you know, there hasn't been what? There hadn't been a 40-goal scorer, I can't remember, in like 20 years or 18 years or some ridiculous number. And the fact that he was this close, I mean, he really did, from a historical perspective, he really had an unbelievable year. And then we kind of got into that other stuff about, you know, scoring even strength and shorthanded. I think we're always going to lean goals because it's the hardest thing to do. It's the hardest thing to do in hockey, score goals.
It's directly measurable. You know, you score the goal, you were there. You made the goal. You know, you can get assists on chipping a puck off the glass at your own blue line. You know, and other guys make a great play on a breakaway or a 2-on-1 or something. You know, you can deflect a puck back to the point, and then it's a shot in, and that's an assist. You know, like, but goals are direct. You know, that's you did the job on that. So
just to play devil's advocate, I agree with what you're saying, but we have seen goals from time to time where a defenseman has the puck at the point, dekes around three guys, fires a rocket of a shot that happens to tick off the tip of someone's stick, and he doesn't get credit for.
Absolutely.
There are cases where the goal scorer wasn't necessarily the one who did the work, but I understand the point you're making. Just wanted to make that point.
Yeah. Right. did go to the front of the net, was there to get the rebound if it became available. You know, but that's true. There's some of that as well, but
a little bit. But but in most cases, the goal scorer is the person who ultimately, you know, put the puck over the line.
Yeah.
Well, especially if you're a guy scoring six shorthanded goals.
Yeah.
I mean, that more often than not is, you know, that's more than a case of being.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's somebody that knows what they're doing. I mean, you know, not to put too fine of a point on it, I think we looked at, you know, just looking at the sheer number of goals and, you know, when he scored them and how many he scored them. And, you know, we talked about, obviously, the even strength and the shorthanded. And the other thing that I kind of came down with that always was in the back of my mind about Connolly, and it's kind of similar to, Gladdy, what you were thinking, but maybe a little different twist, is I asked myself, is Jack Connolly the best player on his team? I ultimately said no. I think JT Brown is the best player on that team. And if Jack Connolly's not the best player on his team, he can't be the best player in the country. We had the same dilemma, or it wasn't really a dilemma back at that point in time. It was pretty clear-cut in our opinion. You know, when Matt Gilroy won the Hobie, you know, we named Colin Wilson Player of the Year because he was better than Matt Gilroy.
Yeah.
At least that's what we thought at the time, and I would argue that to this day that, you know, how can Matt Gilroy be the Player of the Year when he's not the best player on his team?
I think Connolly was better than JT Brown, but I think, you know, kind of what I alluded to in the beginning was he didn't stand out like Brown did sometimes. You know, those big goals, those highlight plays, the big hits. That's not Connolly's game. He's very steady, very consistent. I like that aspect of it. Of his game a lot. One bullet point I wanted to address in this conversation that sprang up is all of the Duluth. I shouldn't say that. Some of the Duluth supporters just point at league. They discount everything that Smith did because of the teams he played against. Two points to make in rebuttal to that. First of all, they also detracted from the points we made about half of Connolly's production came on the power play. So, you act like power play points don't matter. Well, you act like goals against Dartmouth and Princeton don't matter. So is that a wash? Is that a push? And to me, it's a lot harder to score against five ECAC guys than it is against four guys, you know, from the WCHA when you are basically granted possession. They give you possession over the blue line in the zone. You have guys that can outwork, you know, scoring goals starts with possession and putting in scoring opportunities and scoring areas. And that's what you get on the power play. That's your biggest advantage. So to have, you know, that drastic of a split between your even strength production and your power play production, that to me is pretty telling. And the second thing is, you know, sure, Colgate played in ECAC hockey. There's only 22 league games in that. So if you take the bottom six teams, the bottom five teams in ECAC hockey, you play those teams 10 times over the season. Guess how many times Minnesota Duluth played against Anchorage and Mankato? 10. So there you go. and two against Huntsville, by the way. So that's 12 games, out of your 41. And they played 9 games against NCAA tournament teams before the two tournament games. So 11 overall because they were in it. So the schedule thing isn't that strong of an argument for Connolly. If that's what you're, you know, waving your flag about, you got to find something better there to me.
Well, it's an argument, but it's a lazy argument.
It's stereotyping. It's people who don't want to think critically. They believe what they've believed because everything they've learned about hockey they've read on message boards and other blowhards like them who, you know, don't have the capacity to watch games. They won't watch games because they're not interested because they've already made their mind up that it's no good, and then they reinforce that with themselves because I won't watch it because it's no good, and then that's no good because that's what I already assume. It doesn't go anywhere.
Well, and it's funny that, or ironic, or just, you know, the way this thing works out, that, you know, the people that accuse us of having a bias are the ones that are biased in the first place because, you know, you say the ECAC is junk or whatever, you have an Eastern bias or you have a Western bias or this and that. No, we're willing to look at everybody across the country on an even plane and not give them extra weight.
Yeah. Yeah, I had mentioned that. I think Bushy had stepped away. You know, I kind of made a little prologue to this whole thing, and I said, you know, the fans of these teams are the people who are making these claims.
Yes.
You're the one who have the emotional investment. And I love it. I'm happy they do. I'm happy that people love college hockey, and I'm happy they love their teams. So that's where I want. That's, you know, that to me is kind of where that goes.
One point I made, I think, with a few of you via instant message before we did the podcast, too, was, you know, I think we're missing the greater point, too, that, you know, people say, well, Jack Connolly won the Hobie, so he's got to be the best player in college hockey, you know, inch messed up by not naming him that. It fails to acknowledge that the criteria is different, too. You know, there's a lot more that goes into the Hobie than just who was the leading goal scorer. I mean, if that was it, it would be pretty easy to pick. I don't know that they would need a panel. They would just need a calculator. But, you know, we've seen examples as recently as last year where a player like Matt Fratton, you know, you could clearly make the argument that he was the best player in college hockey as far as point production, as far as, you know, what he did, what he meant for his team, whatever. But the other factors that go into the Hobie voting, you know, didn't work in his favor. In a player like Jack Connolly, no, he was not the leading scorer in college hockey, but you look at the other things that go into the Hobie, and I think that's maybe where he won the trophy. So, you know, if people want Inch to just, you know, parrot what the Hobie does every year, well, why would you read us then? You can find out who won the Hobie 15 different, you know, other places. You know, respect us for having an opinion, I guess.
I'm not of the opinion that the character portion of it plays a big role.
I think it can hurt your case. I don't think it really helps too much.
Right. That's what I was going to say. You know, in a case where there's candidates who are even, I think that, you know, if it can hurt you, it will. But I don't think it puts anybody over the top in terms of, you know, he's out in the community, because to a certain extent, everybody's out in the community. I mean, you know, we've been around the game long enough to know that these guys, you know, are out there doing things. All college athletes are out there doing things. I mean, it's part of
the college experience.
It's part of the experience. Exactly. So, I don't think that's anything, you know, and again, that's not a knock on Connolly and the things he does, because I know he's out there doing a lot of things, but, you know, I don't think that should be a determining factor, or I don't think it ends up being a determining factor. I think it might end up being a negative, but I don't think it's something that pushes a kid over the top.
I got to say too, one thing I really liked about Austin Smith, talking to him at the Hobie announcement, and I failed to mention this when we talked about Tampa, but that was just another fantastic event, was the way they did the Hobie announcement this year out at MacDill Air Force Base. You know, just another reason that Tampa was top notch. Anyway, talking to Austin Smith, you know, we credited the Ferrest guys for their brutal honesty after the championship game, you know, saying essentially, don't ask us to say nice things about BC. You know, Austin Smith was very gracious after the Hobie announcement when I interviewed him, but I just said, you know, what's it like to see somebody else win this thing? And, you know, God bless him for being honest and saying, hey, I'm a competitor. You know, I want to be standing up there. You know, it hurts to hear somebody else's name called. I mean, I hadn't heard that before, and that was just kind of a, a refreshing little different take on it.
Yeah,
I don't blame him, and I think, you know, and we said it all along, and I think we probably even said it at the Frozen and on Twitter, and, you know, we thought Austin Smith should win, and we said Conley probably will win.
That worked out what we thought there. Here's one that, I don't know if I want to get into this because it in the long run it doesn't mean anything. It goes too much. It's somewhat related, not entirely related, but it's something to consider, and it's something we've talked about offline. And to me, it's pretty telling. You know, I know that Hobie Baker's a college award. It's based on a college career, a college season, and I think Conley did get a little bit of a bump for career achievement, maybe Chris Drury-like or Gilroy-like. But 30 NHL teams passed on this guy, and their AHL affiliates. 3-0, all of them. The Isle, the Islanders, the Wild, the Oilers, the Blue Jackets, they didn't think they could help him. You know, that, to me, there's something there. I don't know.
Right, and I don't, I don't think that we want people to be making a connection that, you know, saying that Conley shouldn't have won the Hobie because nobody signed him. But clearly, that, as you said, I mean, look at the Minnesota Wild. The team can't score a goal to save its life. And, you know, last year, 2 years ago, they couldn't wait to sign Casey Wellman out of UMass. You know, get some, you know, because they needed offense. So they signed him as a free agent. And, you know, now they've got this kid, you know, the best player in the nation, playing 2 hours away, and he doesn't get a sniff from him. I mean, that to me is, as you said, very telling, you know.
Terry Broadhurst, Nebraska, Omaha. David Eddy, St. Cloud State, got NHL free agent contracts. Guys from Niagara, UConn, Brown, and Union, free agent NHL contracts.
Yeah, Jeremy Welsh signed basically when he was coming off the ice.
Yeah.
Tampa.
Yeah. So.
JT Brown,
Travis Galexic got NHL contracts.
Beaten down the doors to sign JT Brown.
Yeah. So, that, I don't know. Not saying that should determine anything, but,
you know, and
we're not alone. If you think that we're grossly blind to Jack Conley and how great he is, there's a lot of other people who are in charge of bigger hockey things than we are, who also who also kind of felt that way.
Yeah, and I mean, you can, if you're interested in a guy, especially at this point in the season, you can bring him in for an ATO.
Yep.
To an AHL team. You know, let him play a couple weeks. If you like him, go from there. If you don't, so be it. You know, and maybe there are other reasons why, you know, an NHL deal didn't work out and he's heading to Sweden.
Connolly did attend the Wild's prospect camp last summer. So they did take a look at him.
Does he have, I mean, you know him better than any of us certainly do. Does he have family or something in Sweden? Was it a case where he might have declined signing with?
No, I don't think so.
NHL X to, you know, is, you know.
No, I think this was the offer he chose to pursue. I don't know that he got offers elsewhere.
I just, you know, could have happened, and I don't disagree.
I don't see any relevance between that and his success or failure as a college player. But
no, we weren't making that, but I think it's interesting that
as I said, we're not alone.
There are awards out there. I mean, Minnesota's Mr. Hockey Award, for example, used to be very clearly who's the best, you know, pro prospect in high school hockey in Minnesota. Well, that's something very different from, you know, who's most valuable to their team or who's, you know, best in the game.
My Rams are best in the game.
Well, I think that the point we're getting at is not making a correlation between the best player in college hockey and the best prospect. But 9 times out of 10, actually I'd go further than that, 99 times out of 100, the best player in college hockey, assuming he's not signed by or hasn't been drafted, is going to get a look from somebody. And we heard nothing about Connolly getting looked at by any teams. Usually you'll hear those rumblings. You know, we knew 3 or 4 or 5 teams were looking at JT Brown. And it's not an indictment on Connolly. I just want to know why. I'm basically curious as to why he's not getting a look.
You know, and that's not unheard of either. I mean, you look at Ryan Duncan. You look at Brian Bonnet. I mean, there have been several notable Hobie winners that haven't gotten much of an opportunity or haven't done much in the NHL. You know, Junior Lessard is another one who, you know, just was not an overly successful pro player.
But those, I mean, Bonin got a look. He signed. Lessard signed.
Yeah, whatever. It the point's made. It's done.
Players going to Europe and you know, starting out there and then making their way to the NHL is not unheard of either. Tim Thomas, the most notable recent example.
Yeah.
Detroit Viper, Tim Thomas?
Hang around, man. He kept going.
He played with Roddick Bonk. Wasn't Bonk a Viper?
I think he was. Yeah. Sergei Samsonov. And even Gordie Howe.
Oh, that's right.
For one shift.
Yeah.
All right.
I think the Vipers? Oh.
Yes, I recall that.
Yeah, play in some decade. Token, whatever. All right. We're going to issue... we've been about an hour and a half on this already. We're going to not have any deterioration this time. What we will do, we're going to get into a little bit of NHL playoffs, but I think they're still trying to figure that thing out themselves. So far be it from us to interject.
Do we have any score updates?
We have finals.
Do you have a late final?
We have a late final.
4-2, people believe, kind of sharks. Sharks were on the losing end.
4-3
sharks. 4-3. Sorry.
Andy McDonald had a goal.
Andy McDonald from Colgate.
Yeah.
People never saw him play either, and he should have won the Hobie.
He had an assist also.
How things come around.
Actually, let me update that. A goal and 2 assists for Andy McDonald tonight.
There you go. Jess, you last call, anybody? Jess?
Yeah, no, you mentioned Mankato a couple times, and that's been the biggest off-season news, or at least in the part of the country I cover most recently. First of all, the reassignment, I guess, is the proper nice word for saying we aren't going to have you coach anymore, of Troy Judding after many years at Mankato, more than a decade, and I just want to say a shout out to Troy. He was always a great guy to deal with, and gonna you know, miss him in a certain extent. And then you know, the flip side of it is the good news, or the optimistic news, if you're a Mavs fan today, they hired Mike Hastings, longtime USHL head coach, college assistant coach, and finally getting the chance to run his own program down in Mankato, and said he's excited to take on the job. Interesting way they went about it, too. He was essentially the only person they interviewed, and was certainly not the only person who expressed interest in it, but they brought one guy in for an interview, offered him the job, and he took it. So they obviously knew what they wanted down in Mankato, and wish him the best of luck.
All right. Anyone else? Kevin?
I just going to quickly piggyback on that, and I guess with the turmoil of coaching carousel last year, it's actually kind of nice that it's been a relatively stable year this year in that sense.
Yeah, good job, everybody. Yeah. Good job not getting fired, everybody.
We did not get fired.
You all win Coach of the Year.
For this year.
For this year. Dun, dun, dun. Dowd, last call?
I just want to give shout out to Sean Hunwick for his NHL debut. It was something that I don't think a lot of people expected, and it came about in maybe a kind of roundabout manner, but you know, credit to him for making it to the show, and credit to the Blue Jackets and to Todd Richards for making the move to put him in that last game, albeit for 2 minutes. Maybe that's it for him, but I wouldn't count him out in the future.
As an aside, I don't know if that really counts as an NHL debut because he was playing for Columbus.
Wow.
So I don't know. I don't know if that officially counts.
Well, they did play against Gladys Islanders.
There you go.
Islanders!
That doesn't strengthen your case for being legit in an NHL game. I'm sorry.
Islanders. But anyway, pretty cool moment for a guy who deserves it as much as you know, as much as anybody. So
there you go.
I have to add something quick, only because Gladdy will love it.
No.
Well, I was watching Hockey Night in Canada tonight prior to the well, we got the Ottawa Rangers game, but they had a report from the Boston and Washington game prior to the drop of the puck, and the ringside guy down there talked about Tim Thomas and Braden Holtby, the goaltenders, who've been outstanding in that series, and he called it a Titanic matchup of goaltenders, and they came back to the studio, and Ron McLean said they should call the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh series the Titanic matchup of goalies. They're both great until they hit the ice.
Ouch.
There you go.
Wonderful timing right around the centennial.
Exactly.
100 years out.
They go.
All right.
Well, props to Alabama for breaking their national title trophy this weekend, too. I just can't.
Be gone. the crystal thing?
Yeah, yep. They dropped it.
Of course they did. I thought they had the kick. I thought it was blocked. They tried to kick it and it was blocked.
How's the NCAA going to revoke it now?
Not an NCAA trophy.
That's true.
You college football people. All right, I said we weren't going to deteriorate, so I'm hanging up on you guys.
Try to take it.
We'll do another podcast with NHL / offseason / deterioration in the next couple weeks or so. Probably after the first round of the playoffs, we'll dial that one up. So, podcast folk, you can look out for that, or wait and listen for it. You just can't see a podcast. So. That'll be on the road. For Mike Eidelbiss, Jess Myers, Kevin Zeiss, James V. Dowd, my name is Joe Gladyszewski. This is the Inch Podcast.
Just a bunch of hoseheads. I'm glad we're done with these guys.
Yeah!